Okay, welcome back to Computer Science E51. So today we're going to be talking about some basic concepts and a few more advanced data structures, which should allow you to implement solutions to this upcoming problem set, as well as in other problems you may face in your programming career, a little more efficiently and making better use of the memory which is available to you in the computer. So essentially all data types in C are represented under the hood as just simple bit strings, sequences of ones and zeros, which we interpret to mean different things depending on what the data type is. So for example, if you have a char data type, which is just one byte, then it's really just an 8-bit bit string, a sequence of 8 ones and zeros, which we interpret as representing some value on the ASCII table, and which we print as any one of these symbols up on our screen. If you have an int, then that's 4 bytes, typically on a 32-bit machine. So you're seeing a 32-bit bit string, which we see as representing, some integer value. So just to help visualize this, suppose we have a char, maybe we call it char X. Then essentially, we can look at the bit string, and it's just a sequence of ones and zeros. If we have our char set to 1, whatever that happens to represent on the ASCII table, then the bit string looks something like this. Now, C gives us some very handy low-level tools which allow us to manipulate bit strings directly. These are called bitwise operators, and you'll see that they have some very useful applications in different types of programming. So suppose, just for simplicity's sake, that we have 2-bit strings that are maybe 4 bits long. These aren't actual data types in C, but just for simplicity's sake to give a better understanding of what these operations are doing. So suppose X is this 4-bit bit string, and it happens to contain the bits 1, 1, 0, 0, and Y contains the bits 1, 0, 0, 1. So there are 3 bitwise operators which we can use on these 2 bit strings together. We have the AND operator, represented by an ampersand. We have the OR operator, represented by this vertical line. And we also have an exclusive OR operator, represented by this caret you type it in with a shift 6. So these 3 operators, and don't confuse these with the logical Boolean and OR operators, where you'd use in a condition if you wanted 2 things to be true, and then that would evaluate to true, you'd use 2 ampersands. Or if only one needed to be true, you'd use 2 of these vertical lines. This is actually something distinctive and means something completely different in terms of what you're actually doing on the computer, so do make the distinction between the two. But coming back to this, we have the bitwise AND operator. If we were to use this operator with these 2 bit strings, then what essentially is happening is we're producing a new bit string, which is produced as a result of applying this operator over each pair of bits in the 2-bit strings. So we end up with a bit string of length 4, and we're applying this AND operator to each of these pairs of bits. And this AND operator essentially just takes each pair, and if both of them are set to 1, it gives us a 1. If neither of them is 1, it gives us a 0, and if not, and if one is 1 and the other is 0, it gives us 0. So essentially, it determines whether or not both of them are 1. And if you think of 1 as representing true and 0 as false, as we often do in computer science, then you'll see this is essentially just evaluating whether it is true that both of these bits are set to 1 or true. So if we look here, 1, 0, this would give us 0, since not both are 1. The same is true for when they're both 0. We're not just testing whether they're both the same, we're testing whether they're both 1. So this results in 0 as well. And if only this one is 1, then we get yet another 0. So if we move on to look at our next operator, the OR operator, we also produce a 4-bit bit string. This time we're comparing the pairs of bits and seeing whether or not at least one of them is 1. One or the other must be at least 1. So if we have this case where they're both 1, that satisfies the condition that one or the other must be 1, so we get a 1. Here, one or the other is 1, since X has a 1, so we once again will get 1. If they're both 0, we have the condition in which we do get a 0 because there are no 1s. One or the other is not 1. And in this case, since one of them is 1, we get a 1 again. So we end up with 1101. Lastly, we have the exclusive OR operator. And the way this is different from the standard OR operator is that it's only true if one or the other, but not both, are equal to 1. So it's exclusive. Only one can be equal to 1. The other one cannot simultaneously, else it results in a 0. So if we have X and Y both equal to 1, this does not satisfy exclusive OR, even though it would satisfy a normal OR, and we get 0. For 1 and 0, we get a 1. 0 and 0, we have 0. And 0 is 1, we end up with a 1. So this is how we use these 3-bit wise operators to compare 2-bit strings and produce a resultant bit string. There's also another bitwise operator we can use, a unary operator, meaning it takes just one argument. It's this tilde character here, which you get by holding down shift and pressing normally the key next to the 1 key on your keyboard. And what this is a 1's complement or not operator, and essentially what it does is flip the bits. So essentially what flipping the bits means, if that isn't naturally intuitive, is that it goes through the bit string, and every time it sees a 1, it changes it to 0. It flips it on or off, depending on what the setting is, if you think of it as like a switch. And it sends 1 to 0 and 0 to 1. So if I were to perform the unary operator not, or 1's complement, on x, I would end up with 0, 0, 1, 1. So essentially that's how these 4-bitwise operators work, and we'll see in a moment how this is relevant to programming and how we can make use of these operators in practical applications within our code. One more operator that's important to talk about is the shift operator. So suppose you have a bit string x, and once again we'll just use a 4-bit bit string for simplicity, and say we have 0, 0, 1, 0. So if we were to treat this as an integer, maybe it'd be the number 3, a character, maybe it'd be the symbol, which is represented on the ASCII table by 3. It doesn't matter, we're just thinking about the bits in the bit string right now. Put all abstractions aside and just think about how these numbers are moving around in memory. So if we were to use the left shift operator, which is represented by these two less than symbols, these two angle brackets pointing left, and then put a number, say 1 here, this means we are shifting all the bits in the bit string represented by x 1 to the left. And this results in 0, 1, 0, 0. So note that the 1 moved to the left, and a new 0 was moved in from the right. If we had changed this such that 1 was all the way on the left, 1 is shifted out, it doesn't wrap around to the other side, that's not what's happening. We're shifting in zeros to replace any empty spaces that are now here. And anything that is on the leftmost side is just lost. If we were to do a right shift, we have exactly the opposite thing happen. So if we've changed this to 1010 now, so we're shifting, I'll change that to 0010 just for added clarity here. If we shift that right 1, then what we end up with is 0001. Note here that the 1 moved to the right 1 bit place, and I'm assuming that a 0 is moving in from the left. Now, this isn't always an assumption you can make, actually. When you're shifting to the left, you can assume you're getting zeros from the right. When you're shifting to the right, if you're, for example, dealing with a negative integer, then generally you'll often see a 1 move in from the left. Since we keep the sign bit on the left for signed integers, which represents that the number is negative, you'll often see that the compiler will move a 1 in to maintain the size of the bit. But that's actually not part of the language definition of C, so it's not really something you can count on. So when you're shifting your bits to the right, you can't always say for certain whether you're going to get a 0 or a 1 shifted from the left, so it's not something that you should generally depend upon in your code. However, when you're shifting bits to the left, you can be sure that you are going to receive a 0 coming in from the right. Okay. So that's much ado about manipulating bit strings, but it's not necessarily obvious how any of this is all that useful to the things you've been doing in coding. It seems like the abstraction offered by ints and chars makes things a lot simpler to approach, and that sitting here and trying to do things to the bit strings directly is a little archaic and perhaps something that we don't need to concern ourselves with overly. But consider this. Suppose you wanted to store 3 values, say x, y, and z. And you really only need to know if each of these were 1 or 0. Say you're considering them kind of like Boolean values. They can either be switched on or off, they're true or false. So each of these can be either 1 or 0, and this is consistent for all of them. Okay, so if you store these as integers, then you're using 32 bits, and you only really need 1. If you're storing these as shorts, which is a 2-byte integer, just a shorter representation of a number if you don't need as large a number, then you're using 16 bits to store what you could store in 1 bit. If you're really clever and use a char for this, then you're still using a full byte to store something that you could hold in exactly 1 bit. So, if you, for example, were to make use of just a single byte, maybe a char, and you did something clever with these bitwise operators, you could conceive of a way in which maybe you could jury-rig the system here a little bit so that you have this bit represent X, this bit represent Y, and this bit represent Z. And you could contain all of your data within 1 byte, simply based on whether each of these bits is switched on. For example, if I have this scenario, then I know that X and Y and Z are all on. If I have this, X is on, Y is off, Z is on. So this is how a way in which we see we're making much more efficient use of memory, as this data, which really only needs to take up 3 bits, is no longer taking up a separate byte for each of them. Just 1 byte in which each of them can be allocated a certain bit to store their data. So taking a look at another practical application of using these bitwise operators, consider one of the problems you faced in your Sudoku problem set just a couple weeks ago. Near the other end of the problem set, you had to write a function to check whether or not the game has been won. And this involved taking in an array of numbers from each row, column, and box to see which digits were placed in each array, essentially. And you wanted to make sure that you had 1 through 9 in each row, column, and box. So essentially you had to take this array of 9 numbers and then somehow act on it to find out whether or not all of the distinct numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 were in fact present there. So there are a lot of ways you could have approached this problem. You could have, for example, performed a linear search over the array 9 times, looking for a different number each time. You could have perhaps had a separate array of Booleans and set each element to true if you were able to find each element within the array and knock those out one by one. You could have also, if you took a different route, taken a mathematical approach and summed the squares of each of the numbers you found to find a unique solution. And these are all valid, of course, but there's also a way to approach this problem using bitwise operators and storing information in a very succinct way, which makes very good and efficient use of memory. So let's take a look at a way that could have been done. And the basic concept here is we're looking at a situation where we need to keep track, essentially, of whether or not we have 9 values present in an array. So you can think of it as 9 Boolean values, really, whether or not we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And it seems very wasteful to use 9 full Boolean values, however we implement a Boolean, to keep track of these 9 numbers when, really, we just need 2 bytes. We can't really split a byte when we're reserving memory, and we need 9 bits. So it seems like it makes a lot more sense just to take up 9 bits in perhaps a 2-byte or even a 4-byte block, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and perhaps assign to each of these to be responsible for a different number 1 through 9. It seems like if we could set it up in such a way that when we got any of these numbers, we flipped on one of these bits, we could very succinctly and effectively keep track of all the numbers we've taken in, and then check to see if we have those numbers in a unique way. So how would we go about doing this? So, here you see we just have a function that allows us to take in 9 digits. This is just to get the input to demonstrate what's happening in the function. Okay, so see here that I've declared something called a bit string, and I'm initially setting it to 0. So I'm ensuring that all the bits in that 32-bit integer, and you notice I am using a 32-bit value. I'm just using that for simplicity to avoid any distraction. I could have used a short. I could not have used a char in this situation, but anything that was large enough to accommodate those 9 bits and perhaps some extra ones would have been valid. I'm also declaring something called a mask. I'm not initializing to anything because I'm going to change its value later and it doesn't matter, but the bit string, I will emphasize, must be set to 0, as you'll see I'm going to be changing bits in it later and counting on the fact that everything was initially set to 0. So, for 0 through 8, which is to say for every element in my array, I'm declaring my mask to be equal to 1, shifted to the left by the number I'm taking out of the array, minus 1. So if you can imagine that I pull the number 1 out of the array, That means I'm taking the number 1 and I'm shifting it to the, and that is represented like this with a series of zeros followed by a 1, and I'm shifting this 1 to the left 0 times. So I end up just with this. Just this 1 followed by preceded by all of these zeros. Then I'm taking bit string and I'm setting it to bit string using the bitwise OR operator with mask. So what is essentially happening here is if I initially have my bit string here set to all zeros, I'm able to mask this onto here, and any values that are 0 that are now becoming 1 are applied. And I'm able to do this with all the values 1 through 9 and shift them appropriately. Say if I got 2, I'd shift it 1 to the left. I'm able to project this on here in the same way, maintaining that other 1 and getting this new 1. And if you can imagine continuing that for all the values 1 through 9, if and only if I have the values 1 through 9, then I'll end up with a bit string which ends with 9 ones and is preceded all by zeros. And if we interpret that as an integer, remember that each of these positions, 2 to the 0, 2 to the 1, 2 to the 2, 2 to the 3, this following one would be 2 to the 9. Since all of these would be 1, it's essentially 2 to the 9 minus 1, because of the binary number which precedes if this were 1 and all these were 0. 2 to the 9 being 512. 512 minus 1 is 511. If my bit string, and I changed this for a second earlier because someone asked a question about representing in hex. If the bit string is equal to 511 at this point, which means that if we interpret the bit string as an integer, it's 511, which would necessarily mean that all the bits on the right end, the 9 bits on the right end, are set to 1 and all else is set to 0, then that would suggest that we had taken in 1 through 9 and that we had no redundancies in our 9 numbers which were taken in. So just to demonstrate this and to prove that it does in fact work, if I type in the numbers 1 through 9 in any particular order, I get that 1 through 9 are given. And if I were to type any redundancies, I get that 1 through 9 are not given. I'm able to store the information about whether I have each of these numbers using only 9 bits. I'm, of course, allocating 32 bits for the integer, but I could have allocated a short and done this in only 2 bytes. So it's much simpler than keeping around 9 variables, which are responsible for keeping this information, and it's much more efficient in terms of memory. Now, obviously, we're not really saving all that much space in the grand scheme of things. In this particular example, you have gigabytes of memory in modern computers, and we're just doing something very simple here. But if you can imagine applying this to a broader problem, then you can see how being able to save maybe 90% of the memory you normally would have been using can be very effective and increase the speed at which you're able to run your programs, particularly considering that these bitwise operators that we're showing here make use of bitwise operations that are hard-coded into the CPU and which execute very, very quickly. Okay, so let's move on to a discussion of hash tables, since this will be particularly useful on the upcoming problem set if you decide implementing a hash table, which most of you, I assume, probably will be interested in doing. So what is a hash table? Essentially, a hash table is really just an array which stores a set of values. It doesn't differ from an array in most of its properties. There's only one key difference. A hash table is necessarily associated with a hash function. And what a hash function is just a function that takes in a value which you want to store in your hash table, does a little bit of math to figure out where it should be placed on the hash table, and then returns an index of the hash table so you know where to put it. So it basically maps any value to a space on the array. So it's basically in charge of just telling any value where it thinks it should go on the array and sending it there. So the reason we have something like this is that you can distribute values across a hash table, and since a hash function is deterministic, it always returns the same value for any given, the same index for any given value that's taken in, we can assign it to a certain place in our hash table when we're inserting that data, and then when we go back to look it up, since we're applying the same algorithm, we know exactly where we would have placed it, and then we know where we need to look to find it. It's just a way of keeping organized in a way. It's like just as in the same way that maybe you keep your keys in a certain place and you know to look for them there. We know where we would put a number like 8 or 7, and so if we look in the hash table, we can find exactly where it would be and know whether or not we have it without looking over everything that's stored in our data structure. So there's several ways to implement a hash table. Just talking about one of the the simpler methods of doing it. Suppose you have an array which just contains a bunch of slots which contain integers. So this can contain 10 integers. And suppose I had a really simple hash function. It just mods any number by 10. So essentially, it's just looking at the last digit. And if it takes whatever that last digit is, and it sends it to that index of this array. Since this is a 10-element of array, it has the indices 0 through 9. So if the number ends in 8, for example, it'd go to index 8, and it'd put it in here. So if we tried to put 18 in here, we'd end up putting 18 right there. If we wanted to put 27 would end up here in our 7 index, just because we're just taking the last digit, and that's how we're determining the index we're placing this on. So there's a problem there, however, because what if we have a collision? What if we try to introduce another number to our hash table, which is a distinctive number, but it hashes to the same place? For example, if I were to try to add the number 47 now, I try to map it right here, and I already have 27 there, and that's problematic. I can't just overwrite 27, because if I'm just going to overwrite values that I've stored in there and that I presumably want to remember, my hash table is fairly useless. It's not a data structure that's going to help me with anything, because I can't be certain whether or not I'm going to remember my values or not. So one way you can address this problem is through linear probing. And what this means is that you go to where you've been hashed to, but if it's occupied, you keep going until you find an unoccupied space, and then you place your number there. So we could just place 47 here in the array index, which is mapped to by 9. And just place it there. So if we were to look for 47 later, we would know to go here and keep checking until we found 47. And if we got to the end of the list, we would presumably wrap around to the beginning and continue looking until we got back where we started. Now, this seems like it means we would have to check the entire entire hash table, which is somewhat problematic, because what's the point of having the hash table if you're just going to do a linear search which checks over the entire thing? We are fortunate, however, in that if we get to a blank space, we necessarily know that, unless we've been pulling things out, which would break this algorithm, that it can't be in this hash table. Because if this were not here, for example, this were 46, and we were looking for 47, then if we got here and saw a blank space, we would know 47 can't be here, because if we were to have put 47 in this hash table, we would have put it here. And since it's not there, it must necessarily be that it's not present in the hash table. So another way to address a similar situation is quadratic probing. So you would go where you normally would like to hash to, then move ahead 1, then move ahead 4, then move ahead 9. Obviously, it doesn't work on a small hash table like this, but if you had a much larger one, it allows you to skip farther and further, but in a consistent way, so that you know where to look, but there's less probability of a collision happening repeatedly, and perhaps speeds up the time needed to look up a value in your hash function. Carefully using something like quadratic probing, because if you have an array of a certain size, then you could possibly end up in an infinite loop. The same goes actually for a linear probing method. If you fill up your array and it's not present, you have to remember to stop when you reach the index you started at, lest you continue in an infinite loop and never resolve whether or not you found your element or not. So this is, of course, all fine, but what if we have more numbers that we want to put in the list than we have spaces in our hash table? Do we just need to make a larger hash table? Or can we maybe come up with a solution that lets us continue to add things dynamically? And when I say dynamically, you should immediately think of dynamic memory allocation. So using malloc in some way. So we could just keep making this array larger, but then our hash function is only mapping to these, our indices, since we can't just change our hash function on the fly, unless we're making use of global variables in some way, and then things get a little more confusing. It seems like there's a more efficient way of doing this, a simpler way. So what we could have instead of an array of values is an array of pointers to the starts of a set of linked lists. And then in each linked list, we could contain all the values which were hashed to this particular element. So if we were to do the same mod by 10 approach and place a linked list pointer in each of these, we could point to the beginning of a linked list to each for example, here, each number that ends with 0, and contain them all in this linked list. And then we could add an arbitrary number of values which end with 0 to this linked list and continue expanding it indefinitely until we ran out of memory. So that would be called separate chaining. So let's take a look at an example of how we might implement separate chaining within the context of a hash table. So you'll notice here that I'm pound defining my hash table size. I'm not necessarily hard coding it in terms of a magic number. I'm making it a constant that I can change before compiling relatively easy from here. I'd suggest that in approaching this problem on your problem set, you do something similar. Particularly if you want to work on trying to make your solution more efficient by fine-tuning it later on, it's kind of a pain to go through all of your source code and change things and hope that everything's consistent. And it's awful to try to work through a bug that is caused just by simply forgetting to change the value which represents your hash table size in one part of your program after you've changed it somewhere else. If you keep up this layer of abstraction, you're able to change everything in one go, and it makes things a lot simpler, and it also makes your code a little easier to read as just an added bonus. So you see here, as we've covered in previous weeks, we have the struct node for a singly linked list, relatively basic. Here we have a hash function. We're returning the val modded by the hash table size. Why is this a good hash function for what we're doing here? We're only dealing with integer values. So with integer values, we can kind of assume a reasonably equal distribution of numbers in terms of what the last two digits are going to be. We can make that assumption about our set. We're going to tend to see sets of numbers in which there's a deal of variation among what the last two digits are. So by just modding by 100, we're able to get those last two digits, and modding by 100, which is the hash table size, ensures that everything that is returned by our hash function is a legitimate index value of our array. If you were dealing with ASCII values, something other than integer values, you wouldn't be able to do something as simple as this. You'd have to come up with some other function which makes use of the properties of the ASCII values in the string, perhaps, you were taking in. If you were dealing with a word, perhaps a dictionary of words, if this seems like something that you might be approaching implementing in the near future. Perhaps you could make use of some mathematical operation between the ASCII characters, perhaps adding up the sums and modding them, or performing some other mathematical operation. Things you're going to want to look for in a good hash function are ensuring that you get a relatively equal distribution of values across the hash table. Because if you can imagine, for example, if you were to have a 26-element hash table, this is a bit of an aside from what we're doing here, but something that's worth talking about. If you were to store a series of words in a hash table, such as this, and you had hash functions that, for example, just took the first letter, and based on what the first letter of your word places it in a particular index value of the hash table. For example, you have 26 elements here, and anything that starts with an A goes here, anything that starts with a B goes here, etc., until you get to the bottom where anything with a Z starts here. That's not really the best hash function. And why is that? It makes logical sense, but if you think about it, if you're looking up a word that starts with an A, then you're going to have to look through a lot of words here, presumably, because any dictionary you're working with probably is going to have a lot of words that start with the letter A. However, if you look down here at words that start with Z, you're going to get zoo, zebra, and maybe a few others, but not nearly as many as ones that start with A. So you're not distributing things evenly across your hash table, and it seems like you could distribute them a little better so that your average look time is much better, and for common hash values, you'll be able to get those words out of the dictionary or your data structure a little bit quicker and more efficiently. So, coming back to looking at the implementation of the linked list itself, we see here we just have some very very basic linked list code with a little bit of hashing going on here. We're hashing the appropriate list in the hash table by taking the hash of the value. You recall that our hash function simply mods by our hash table size, which ensures fairly equal distribution when we're dealing with integer values. We're then pointing the pointer in the hash in the new node to the first block in the list. Since the hash table contains pointers to the struct nodes, if you note in the definition of the hash table, it's a It's an array of pointers to struct nodes. So pointers to the beginning of linked lists, which consist of these struct nodes. The struct nodes they're pointing to are the first blocks in the linked list. Then when we get the hash value by running our hash function on the value, we're pointing the next pointer in the new node, which we have just initialized above, to the address of the first block in our list pointer, or in our linked list. And what this essentially is doing is inserting our new node at the head of the linked list. Why at the head? It's always better to insert something at the head of your linked list unless it's important to your algorithm that the values be sorted in the linked list. Because to do so at the end, if you were just to go all the way in to the end of the linked list and append it there, is much more time-consuming. You have to iterate over every element in the linked list. It's much easier to just manipulate the pointers at the beginning of the list, point towards the first element, and then insert yourself by having the beginning of the linked list point to you. You can do it in constant time, as opposed to linear time, which would be the result if you were to try to append to the end of the list. And you see here we are, in fact, accessing the pointer to the first node in the hash table, since the hash table is elements are what points to the point to the beginning of our pointers, or rather our linked lists, which contain our nodes, and we're pointing that to our new node. So we're effectively inserting our new node at the beginning of the linked list, which is pointed to by the hash table element, which our hash function pointed us to. And much in the same way, we would look up a value. We find the same hash value. Notice that we're doing the same exact thing to find the hash value in the lookup as we do for the insert. And the reason we do this is because we want to maintain absolute consistency between what we're doing to find out where we would hash a value in our insert as in our lookup, so that we can be sure when we do this lookup that if we don't find it, then it can't be anywhere in the hash table. It allows us to search just the portion that we know that it would be in without having to search everything and know for certain whether or not we do have it in our data structure. And then you see we're getting a pointer to the beginning of our list. Well, we have not reached the end of the list. We check if we've found the number and then jump to the next node in the linked list until we get to the end. If we get to the end without finding it, we return false. Otherwise, we return true. Fairly simple linked list code like you've seen before. The only difference is that we're going to the beginning of a specific linked list based on a hash value and making use of an array of pointers to separate linked lists so that we can get specifically to where we expect a value to be based on how we hash it. And you can see here that I'm just inserting a bunch of numbers into the hash table in this example using that insert val function as part of the demo, just getting an integer, and then we look up whether it's there or not. So we have 4, 8, 15, 16, 23, 42, and a few other arbitrarily chosen numbers here. So if I were to run hash now, 4, 8, 15, 16, and just in case you think I hard-coded this to make it look like it works, 99, not found. Any other number is not going to be contained within the list. 31415. So essentially, we are able to. And if you notice, 31415 and 15, modded by 100, which is our hash table size, they both hash to the value 15. So we know we must necessarily have a linked list pointed to by the 15th element of our hash table, and that we are successfully iterating over it and finding each of those values. That's something you want to consider when you're debugging your problem sets this coming week, because. If you have some kind of bug where you're only maintaining one value for each hash function, that's something you definitely want to check on, as it can cause some serious problems in the consistency between your lookup and your insert. Sure. So essentially, when we're hashing these values to determine where on the hash table they're located, all we're doing, since these are just integer values, is we're performing a mod by 100, which is just giving us the last two digits. 31415 mod by 100 is 15. 15 mod 100 is 15. So that means that we have a linked list pointed to by this 15th element, and that this linked list contains the value 15 because we've inserted it, and it contains the value 31415. So we can see from this result that unless it's just reporting what's happening in the data structure incorrectly, which it does not seem to be because it's consistent with what we noted that we did insert, that it is able to find 15 and 31415 1.5, and that it's traversing this linked list correctly and able to identify the values that's contained within. If you are debugging and you find that you can only perhaps find the most recent value with a certain hash value that you inserted into your linked list or into your data structure as a whole, then it could be that you're not traversing your linked list correctly, and this is just something you want to keep in mind when you're debugging to ensure that you not rack your brains over problems that could be more easily solved than maybe your approach is. Okay, so having addressed that, let's move on to a different type of data structure. You might remember earlier in the course, we talked briefly about the concept of binary search trees, particularly in relation to when we implemented binary search. If you recall, binary search allows us to take a sorted array of integers, and then by iterating over them in a certain, well, not quite iterating them, by searching them in a certain way, we're able to find any number, whether it's there or not, in log n time rather than linear search, where we'd have to check every single element to see whether or not it's what we're looking for, which runs in linear time, obviously. By using a binary search tree, we can get an expandable data structure as opposed to an array, which is this constant fixed data structure, which we cannot alter. It's this certain size, unless you do something tricky, copying it into a new larger array. It's not really expandable. Trying to go beyond it gives you a segmentation fault, as I'm sure you've all experienced. A binary search tree, in contrast, consisting of these structures here, you could think of them as branches if you like, with pointers to a left branch, pointers to a right branch, and a value. These allow us to construct a data structure in which values are arranged in such a way that any value that is less than a previous branch is placed to the left of it, and a value that is greater is placed to the right of it. So for example, if I were to have the values 4 and 73 in this tree as well, they might be inserted here. So you see, perhaps we inserted 15 first, that became the root of the tree, you can think of it. And then subsequently we inserted 4. Since 4 is less than 15, we created a new branch and pointed this left pointer to this new structure. This would be, a struct branch pointer. Maybe called left, and we'd insert this here. Since there is nothing else for this to point to, we'd set these to null. It's always important to remember to set your pointers to null, lest garbage data make you point to something arbitrary that doesn't actually mean anything, and then you get a segmentation fault. For example, if I hadn't set this to null, it might have had a value like in hexadecimal 10101010, which I can assure you that you absolutely cannot access and do not want to try to dereference, as you'll end up with a segmentation fault and see your program freeze or just crash. So always remember to set these to null initially until you add something else. And then, for example, you could also have a number like 62 here, and that would cause this pointer to point to another branch. And then having no more leaves, you could think of them as being, it would have these pointers set to null, and this would be sitting here. And perhaps this is null as well, since there are no other values. And the reason this is useful is because, essentially, if you're looking for a particular value, say we want to see if 16 is in this tree, we go to the base, we see we have 15, we know that if 16 is here, it needs to be on the right of 15, we go here, we have 73. If 16 here is here, it's got to be to the left of 73 because it's less, and that's how we're arranging things in our binary search tree. We go down here, we see we have 62, since that is not 16 and there are no more further children, then we know 16 cannot possibly be in here. Now, obviously we had to search almost everything in the tree to be able to find that particular example, but if we were to look for, say, 5, we go to 15, 5 is less than 15, we go to 4, 5 is greater than 4, there's nothing there, we know it's not there, we only had to check two things. So if you can imagine a much larger binary search tree, this tree data structure allows us to more concisely or much more effectively search the structure based on the way we've organized it in order to say something about the contents of the data structure without having to check over every single thing. So this is just a very easy visual example to kind of see how the way you structure your data makes a big difference in terms of how easily you can perform a lookup operation, or even to insert new data. For example, if I wanted to place a 74 here in an array, I'd have to I'd have to resort everything to keep it, if I wanted to keep it in order and make it manageable for searching over it, or I'd have to create a new array if my array had filled up, perhaps. Here I can just dynamically allocate a new node, place it somewhere in memory, and then point this to that. So you can see that this is dynamically expandable as well as more easily searchable than something like an array. Now what's the downside of that, however? What do arrays have going for them that something like a tree does not? In an array, if you know exactly where something should be, like in a hash table where you just had your values stored somewhere in an array, if you could assume perhaps, for example, that you would have no collisions and you could just like pull it out of there, then arrays give you the benefit of a constant lookup time. You can find, if you want to find what's in the fifth element of an array, you can do it like that. It's extremely quick. It'll take like half a nanosecond maybe, and you've got the value. By contrast, if you want to find something in a linked list, maybe you have to iterate over the entire list and just to get to that value, even if you know that they're in order. You have to look through everything, and it takes a while. So a compromise is something called a try, which is essentially like a tree filled with arrays. And it allows you to store your data in a kind of an organized way, but also get the benefit of the constant lookup time of arrays to quickly get to information contained lower in the tree. So if you can imagine, for example, a case in which you wanted to find a particular alphabetical string and see if you have perhaps in a dictionary or like a set of words, whether or not that is kept there. You could store all the words you have in your dictionary in something like a try. And what essentially a try consists of is a series of data structures. We'll call them these try structures. And what's contained in that is a Boolean value. And that comes into play when you're considering whether or not you've reached the end of a string of characters, for example, followed by an array of essentially branching options at that point. So if we were looking at a string of characters, if we're assuming that the first one we go to after this root represents the first character in the string, then any subsequent characters, if we're to consider them, we'd find information at them by going to the array index which corresponds to that next character. So to demonstrate that, suppose this is an array and it has 26 elements. So I'm starting right at the root here, so this doesn't actually really represent any character. But if I wanted to look for a word, a simple word, just like, we'll say cat. So we're looking for this C first. And so since we have 26 elements here, we can assume that, I suppose index 2 would correspond to this C. So we go here, and maybe we find a pointer to another try. And we'll say this represents, this is the parent of all tries, which represent words that begin with the letter C. If this were a word in and of itself, maybe we'd set this to true. This is false up here. And that would mean that we'd reached the end of a valid word. We'll set this to false for now, since C really is not a valid dictionary word. It doesn't make sense to think that. If we're looking for cat, we'd next want to see if A at index 0 points to a try. Say it does. We end up with another try here. CA is not a legitimate word, so this is false. Maybe we want to see if T has anything. We go to one more struct, this try. This is true, because we end up at the end of a legitimate word, a word that is in fact in our dictionary, cat, assuming we implemented our try correctly to represent all these words. And the reason we have this Boolean value, one might think, well, couldn't you just see if all your array pointers here are set to null? Because if there are no more letters left, then, I mean, obviously you've reached the end of the word. Consider the case where you don't just have cat, but maybe you have cats, maybe you have cattle, maybe you have catcher. Then you have situations where each word is also a subset of other subsequent words. And this allows you to concisely express the cat as part of something like catch and catchers, having tries that represent letters contained in each word. As a prefix of other words without representing those. And allows us to kind of consolidate that in a way by just appending this Boolean value. So essentially, And the benefit of this is that we can take the root of our try and then get down to this word and determine whether or not it is in our database, essentially, our data structure, by doing these constant time lookups in these arrays, which is very quick. We just have to do n array lookups, where n is the number of characters in the word, for example, in this particular example. And we get to our result, which tells us whether or not cat is in our data structure. So what's the downside here? For a large dictionary, we're probably going to end up with a lot of these struct tries. And each of these structs, they contain 26 pointers. That's probably 4-byte pointers if we're using 32-bit machines, which we have been throughout the course. And plus another 4-byte value, perhaps 4-byte value to store this Boolean. So it seems like we're using a lot of memory to do something like this. And if you've already checked out the big board on the CS50 website, for example, where we have a list of mostly at this point staff who've resubmitted what they did last year to kind of show the speeds which their benchmark is showing for their spell checker programs, you notice that some of them are very fast, but they're using hundreds of megabytes of space. And they're probably using something similar to a try, because if you consider this, you have to have all these branching structures for all these combinations of letters, and you end up with a lot of structs hanging around in memory, and you're going to be taking up a lot of space. So when you're looking to develop programs that run efficiently and quickly, you're going to want to consider not only the throughput speed, but also the degree to which you're using memory responsibly and effectively. Because something that runs in 2 seconds as opposed to 10 seconds, but which uses 500 megabytes of memory as opposed to 5 megabytes of memory, isn't really all that useful to anyone. Because although it's nice to have something that runs that much quicker, if it's going to slow your machine to a grinding halt and cause trouble for all the other processes which you have running on your computer, then it's not necessarily as useful as a program which is a little more conservative about its memory usage, but which does not necessarily get the job done quite as quickly. That being said, for a large data structure, like the ones we'll be using, tries are very useful because they allow for a very quick lookup of which words are contained in your dictionary. And since that's a very strongly a conceptual thing we've just been talking about, it's really abstract, we do have an example in C of the implementation of a slightly different try. In this one, rather than looking at the first character of the word and then looking at the next character and the next character, we're looking at a try where, once again, we're storing values in the form of integers. And so what's happening here is that instead of looking at, like, the first character, I'm taking a number like, say, 8,081, and I'm looking at the last digit. I'm getting that using a modulus by mod by 10, getting that 1 out of there, and then dividing this by 10 to get rid of it, and then doing the same thing over and over. And I have an array of size 10, so for each possible value there, 0 through 9, I can go to another try, and essentially I'm making the problem smaller each time, and I'm able to get more and more specific about what I'm looking for, and then my try, by virtue of the way it's arranged, will be able to tell me whether or not that value is stored somewhere very quickly by allowing me these constant time lookups, which get more and more particular with regard to what I'm looking for. And obviously, the base case in the previous problem, when I know I've reached the end of my word and I need to check if the Boolean value is switched to true, was that as I'm iterating over those characters, once I'm out of characters, so I suppose I'd be getting to the terminating character, that \0 that appears at the end of all strings, if you remember that from problem sets such as problem set 2, crypto. In this case, when I got to this last number and I divided that by 10, I'd end up with 0, because anything less than 10, which I divide by 0 in C or in any other programming language, is going to give me just 0 since we round down. So here's my struct for a try. You'll notice that in this particular struct, I've allotted an integer for a value. So I'm storing the value, whichever was the last digit, within the try. That's not actually necessary. I'm just doing it for purposes of perhaps if you wanted to keep that there while debugging, if you're getting a little more comfortable with using GDB, or if you're not, maybe you would like to consider trying it out a little bit, because it's a very powerful tool, particularly when you're dealing with complex data structures, to really see what's going on under the hood and understand what's happening in your code, what might be going wrong. Being able to look at that value and seeing what it is and what's going on at the particular point is very helpful to you, the programmer, in determining what might be going wrong. but it's not necessary to your data structure. It's not information that has to be used to find anything. So don't think that it is something necessary. Just clear up any misconceptions that may have arisen from seeing that. Note that we do have an array of 10 elements which point to different structs because we have 10 possible branching paths because the last digit can be any of 10 different combinations. And we have a bool valid number which lets us know that at this point, do we have a valid number? For example, if you look at 8,081, it's very possible that after two of these, that I would get to a struct in which I would have also reached that particular struct if I'd given the number 81. And if it's true there, that means the number 81 is contained within my data structure. So looking at the rest of this, we have some more lookup functions, which are actually very similar to what you might have seen in a linked list. The only difference is that rather than just simply jumping to whatever is pointed to by next, we grab what we're jumping to from our array of pointers to tries. So it's essentially like a little hash function kept right within our struct, or a hash table rather. And our hash function, if you care to think about it in that way, is modding by 10. So essentially we're determining where we're going to go from here based on a sort of hash function where we're modding by 10 and then going to that position. And also note that it is of course necessary to set all of these pointers to null when you're inserting a try struct into the table, because otherwise you could end up pointing to things which don't actually exist in memory and end up with a segmentation fault. Remember that any time that you're pointing to some other a region of memory in a struct or else that you want to initialize it to null before you set it to something that has meaning, or else you will generally run into a segmentation fault. Here you see insert val. It works similarly. It traverses the list or the tries in much a similar way. One main difference is that if you consider the fact that as it's going through this, it might reach a point at which the try it wants to go to does not exist yet. And this is the beauty of dynamically expandable data structures. Not every combination of tries has to exist at any point. You can simply add it when you want to add a value which needs to make use of it. For example, if I had never had numbers larger than 16, then I'm not going to have a series of tries more than two deep because I only had to use these two digits. But if then I want to add 8,016, I'm going to get to the try in which I know I have 16, and then I'm going to want to add a try that's pointed to by the 0th element dynamically, and then add a try to that try pointed to by the 8th array element, and then in that try, set it to true to indicate that I have the number 8,016. So the way we do that is by checking if next try is equal to null, and initializing our next try's values, building this try on the fly right here, and then pointing the root try in its array, which is the root try being the try we're at right now, to this next try, which we just allocated in memory, essentially appending it into the hash table that's essentially contained within this try structure. And then we just go to the next try, and when we do get to the point where, in this case, val does not equal zero, or when val does equal zero, pardon me, then we know we've gotten to the end. And we mark it as true because we are inserting, and when we create this try, we want to assert that we do, in fact, have this number represented. And once again, just as a proof of concept here, we have the numbers 5, 6, 61, and 63 being inserted into this try. And if we were to go ahead and run this try, if we look for the number 5, 6, 61, 63, 53 should not be found, and it's not. So that's clearly seen a very quick and effective, though also costly in terms of memory, method by which you can store values within your data structures. And with that being addressed, you guys should be equipped to start implementing some of these data structures on this upcoming problem set. And good luck tackling the spell checker. I'll see you next week.